Coming up on Tech Nation, Dr. Rita Caldwell, the first woman to head the National Science Foundation. Today, she's founded and chairs Cosmos ID, a bioinformatics company on a mission to change how we diagnose disease. Then on Biotech Nation, DICE Molecules attempts to make biopharmaceutical drugs infused into the bloodstream into easy-to-take pills. We talk about their Darwinian approach. And we'll also hear from leading biosciences and their efforts to intervene when a person goes into shock. All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's take five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 minutes.
We're in a pickle. In fact, all of us are in it. It's the fake news pickle. We've been heralding for years how great it is that we have the internet and that we have so much media, from more television channels to music and audio choices to social media with its short text bursts, news blasts, photos, videos, and more. All this more has become less, of course, because we now are in an age where anyone can say anything, and they do. Still, the impact of not knowing the truth, of not getting the correct information, can be profound. While some folks have declared us to be a post-fact society, I believe that just ain't so. You really think the world will put up with their GPS leading them hither and yon? With the supermarket totaling up just any old amount for you to pay? With airline flights which don't exist? But the same demand for correctness is difficult to detect when not easily connected to something close at hand and verifiable. So when it comes to fake news, we are all kind of putting up with it, journalists included. For one thing, the rules of fake news make it impossible to cover responsibly. Journalists share the same challenge as teachers. Teachers are loath to write incorrect information on the board and then point to it and say, "That's incorrect." They know someone will look up at that very moment and the misinformation will go right into their brain. Bad information, when written, has to have a big red circle slash simultaneously appear so that no one will take it as the truth. Audio is even more challenging. How do you red circle slash audio? While you're watching a person on TV or on audio or radio or podcast, it's treacherous to say the following is misinformation. You, the listener, must remember to forget it or remember to dismiss it when you hear it in the future. But your brain doesn't work that way. It doesn't carry tags on information saying it's false. It's no wonder journalists are downright flummoxed on how to grab onto and fight this avalanche of fake news. And a good part of the problem is the characteristics of an avalanche. A single gaffe, like Libertarian presidential candidate Gary Johnson, unfortunately asking, "What is Aleppo?" That we can handle. It's one instance. It's a simple fact that we can recognize instantly and run for a single news cycle. But an avalanche, a never-ceasing avalanche of misinformation, that's just not possible. The profession of journalism as we know it today is no match for fake news fakeouts. In top misinformation form, the moment anyone makes a statement, the faker makes a post that changes the number or restates its factual nature incorrectly or assigns fictional intent. Post the items, let them be copied, and then remove. And the very best way is to create an avalanche of this activity, to simply put out so many misstatements and shove out so much misdirection, there isn't enough time to even recognize it all, much less correct it. Even while journalists are attempting to set the record straight, news fakers are hard at work gaming their get-out-the-truth efforts. Journalism, as we have come to practice it, was developed before the speed of the internet, the untamed power of social media and digital information, and quite simply, before the ability to create a fake news avalanche. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Five Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancourt.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, Dr. Rita Colwell, the first woman to head the National Science Foundation, and a distinguished university professor at the University of Maryland. We'll talk about her company, Cosmos ID. Then on Biotech Nation, an effort to make biopharmaceutical drugs, which normally are infused, into pills, and one company's approach to intervene in cases of shock. Dr. Rita Colwell has had a long and distinguished career as a scientist, a professor, an inventor, and even an entrepreneur. I asked her, "You've had many signature positions in your career. Did you know when you accepted the position of director of the National Science Foundation, this would be the one that stuck?"
That's a wonderful aspect of it. Everybody recognizes and respects the National Science Foundation. And so I think you get a kind of an aura and a rapport with everybody, including both sides of the aisle in Congress, which I really was very impressed with. I felt very good about that.
Now, when you are president of NSF, do you have to deal with Congress to get funding, or is it kind of given?
No, you really do have to deal with Congress. You spend a lot of time, or at least I spend a lot of time on the Hill, really explaining what we're doing, letting them know what our plans were, because it was really important for them to understand that everything was above board, straight, honest. This is what we need to do. This is why it's good for the country. And they understood. And I think they may have had their differences in their political views, but fundamentally, they do want what's best for the country. And if you're able to explain to them that what you're doing in science, engineering, technology, mathematics is very important for the country, and they can understand it, then they're supportive.
So it's a lot about communication.
Indeed, a great deal about communication.
Now, during President Obama's State of the Union speech in January 2016, almost a year ago now, he announced the National Cancer Moonshot. And in the past year, over 70 companies have made commitments to support that effort. Can you remind us what the National Cancer Moonshot is and what the company you founded, Cosmos ID, has contributed?
We're very excited about this opportunity because it is sort of the next important qualitative leap to finding cures to cancer. And actually, I should say cancer is plural because it's really not one entity. It's a mixture of them. And understanding the genetics, the human genetics, but also in the case of the company that I have founded, the role that microorganisms play, bacteria, viruses, fungus, parasites, play in either triggering cancer or, when it occurs, exacerbating it, making it worse. So it's an exciting time to take all of these tools of science and engineering to make that next big step, that next jump in being able to understand cancer, how to treat it. And what's very interesting is that the immunology side of it is turning out to be quite an important factor. Now, the company I founded uses nucleic acid, DNA, and the RNA, other types of nucleic acid, to determine exactly what's present. So we can extract the DNA, let's say from a tumor or from the tissue surrounding the tumor, extract the DNA, and then with the algorithms, with a computer algorithm that we've developed, we can, within minutes, determine exactly the bacteria down to species, strain, and substrain, the viruses, the fungus, and the parasites, everything at once, within minutes. And this is really exciting because it means we can diagnose so rapidly and be able to treat appropriately and quickly.
Now, there's so many aspects to this. First of all, that a cancer tumor might have bacteria within it, might have fungi within it, viruses within it. That's a new concept to me, but is that a new concept to scientists?
Not really. It's been known for a long time. I think some of the studies go back 30, 40, 50 years, that there are viruses that trigger cancer. There are viruses that, in the presence of certain toxic chemicals, they're called a co-carcinogen, will cause cancer. So we're really kind of revisiting some of the early studies in a much more refined and elegant molecular way of determining the information.
And, of course, there's this really crucial step now. You go from the organic to information. And once you have it in information, well, you can keep using it again and again, looking at it, assembling it, putting other things together with it.
Absolutely. And that's, again, another fascinating part of the work that we're doing, because every study we do adds to the database. And so we're able then, accumulating all this information, to get a pattern, a picture, to understand for the next step the prediction that we can make based on the accumulated data. So everything is kind of a win-win for the patient, for the science, for the physician.
Now, there was some technology involved. You didn't use off-the-shelf technology.
We took advantage of the fact that there is a genetic revolution that started about 1970, so that's 40 or 50 years ago. And it has, in a logarithmic way, that is, in a very steep way, has risen to provide us with some fabulous tools. So I think we've been able to take advantage of the ability to extract DNA and sequence it. There have been wonderful companies that have developed sequencing machines. And what's nice about our computer algorithm is that it doesn't matter what machine is used. Just give us the sequence and we go from there.
Well, we think about things like Word or accessing the internet, and we realize accessing the internet's a great example. You do it on your phone. You do it on your computer. You do it on anybody's computer. You do it on your tablet. It's all different technology, but you get to the same place. That's where you're going with this.
Absolutely. We're moving toward a handheld device for a physician to be able, at the bedside, take a throat swab or a blood sample, and within minutes be able to tell you precisely what it is that's causing your infection and how best to treat it, because the information we gather is not only to determine what's there, but what genes it carries with respect to antibiotic resistance or how it is pathogenic. Does it invade? Does it produce a toxin? Does it do a variety of things that don't make you feel very good? So one of the discoveries, however, is that the assumption has been for over 100 years, a process we call Koch's postulates, named after Robert Koch, a German physician in 1890, who very wisely, when we were just beginning to understand that bacteria were there and caused disease, that he postulated that you must, in a disease state, isolate the bacterium or whatever agent, and then reintroduce it into an animal model to reproduce the disease and then re-isolate it, called Koch's postulates. The assumption is that it's a single organism that causes the disease. We're finding, in studies we've been doing on diarrheal disease, for example, that it's usually 4 to 10 pathogens that are present. It can be a parasite along with a virus and a bacterium that causes you to land in the hospital. So we have to revisit Koch's postulates and understand that it's what I would call a polymicrobial infection that we deal with. And I think in the years ahead of us now, we're going to understand that much more accurately and effectively.
Now, Rita, if we look at that, when you take your swab, the bad guys in the gang, they don't say, oh, take me, so you're going to have to go through, there's billions of bacteria and fungi and everything else in there. How do you draw from those what's wrong?
Well, it's really much more simple.
Hooray. What good news.
Not so complicated, because we have, over the last 6 or 7 years, built a very elegant, very accurate, cleaned up database. So the process that we use for identification is essentially matching the bits and fragments that come out of the sequencing machine, very rapidly matching them up against the database and binning them, and then that allows us to make the diagnosis. And we use mathematics, a Bayesian probabilistic approach. Sounds very complicated. What it means is you kind of figure out if a lot of them are there, that's what it is.
Got to be one of those.
Exactly.
That's true. The larger the database, the smarter you got to get about it. You don't buy the New York Times and start from the top left corner of the front page and read it all the way through. You figure out where you want to go.
Exactly.
Now, how far along are you with the handheld device?
Right now, we are very much involved with a variety of hospitals, clinics, even Orange County Water Authority, because making sure the water that you drink doesn't have pathogens. This is a technique that works beautifully there, and especially since we have to reuse water because of the drought, that is wastewater, we want to make sure it is, when it's treated, clean and safe. So I think that right now we're able to diagnose very easily. The major step on getting to the handheld is being done in collaboration with a couple of companies that have devised ways of producing miniaturized sequencers. Our plan is to put our algorithm, our computer attachment, to their device, and that at first is going to be clunky. Remember the original cell phones? They were not nice and
bone
tiny.
Anchors.
That's right. They were sort of like great big bread boxes that you carried around. Well, maybe the first ones will be like that, but I think we will get to the point where it'll be like a cell phone.
And again, the beauty of information, it doesn't weigh anything.
Precisely.
So you can sit there with the heart of this company, having the intelligence, improving the data, improving the algorithm. And as the technology, the physical technology evolves, you can just take advantage of it.
Better, absolutely. Faster, cheaper.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn. My guest today is Dr. Rita Colwell, an environmental microbiologist. Dr. Colwell is Distinguished University Professor at the University of Maryland College Park and Johns Hopkins University Bloomberg School of Public Health, perhaps most widely known as the first woman to direct the National Science Foundation. Among her many credentials, Dr. Colwell has authored or co-authored 750 reports and publications. She's the founding editor of GeoHealth, a new journal from the American Geophysical Society. Dr. Colwell is also the founder and chair of the bioinformatics company Cosmos ID. Well, as science evolves, a lot of people don't realize that it's an important activity for science to create new and responsive and responsible journals. So tell us about GeoHealth and tell us about why we need new journals.
GeoHealth is a journal that is published by the American Geophysical Union, a society composed of geologists, climatologists, weather scientists, chemists, biologists. It's interdisciplinary, and it focuses on everything from predicting the weather to understanding solar bursts in the sun. And now it is moving toward understanding the interaction between us as humans and our environment. This is really very important. It turns out that the new infectious diseases like Ebola, MERS, which is derived from camels and infecting people, SARS, which was discovered to be originated in bats and infecting people, we're finding that these rare and unusual diseases come from the environment. How does that happen? Well, some of it is related to climate and the changes in the weather patterns and the increase in temperature of water and air. So the journal is really focused on public health, human health, related to our environment on planet Earth.
So how would I, as a scientist, figure out that I might have something to contribute to this journal?
A scientist who is working on climate change or has an interest in weather patterns and the influence, for example, Katrina and the hurricanes that struck Louisiana, a very good friend of mine, Dr. Bennett, who is now at Rutgers, is a mycologist, and as a result of the hurricane, her house in New Orleans became infested with fungus. Well, being a scientist, she studied them and is publishing a book on fungus associated with the hurricanes. I mean, that's sort of a dramatic but very useful example of how the environment affects us as health in health. And so I think we need to understand also the kinds of microorganisms, bacteria, viruses that can come out of environments that we invade as we cut down forests, move into areas that we had not lived in before, and become exposed to these kinds of microorganisms that we've not been exposed to in the past, and some will create disease.
I'm sort of rethinking as I speak with you here. We have weather events, tsunamis, we have earthquakes. We see so many things happening that clearly have devastating effects on the land and as a result obviously have effects on microorganisms and humans within it. And we also have man-induced things, human-induced things. I think of Deepwater Horizon. And finally, I also think of we just don't know who we are even in stasis, that the physical environment of where we live actually affects our health in a far more profound way than I think we realized before.
I think that we have had some dramatic effects, such as the heat waves that caused a lot of deaths of the elderly and the very, very young. That is pretty clear. We can see the connection. We can't see the connection so clearly, for example, with ocean warming. We've just published a paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science showing that having the opportunity to look at plankton samples collected 50 years ago and each year to the present, that there were changes in the microorganisms and certain pathogenic microorganisms for humans became more abundant. And we were able to correlate that with increased infections caused by those bacteria in Europe. We did this study with a group in Italy, Germany, and in England. And so we were able to show this very interesting correlation of ocean warming and human health, mediated by the bacteria that are associated with plankton that can affect humans.
This is an open access journal. What does that mean, fully open access journal?
Open to the public. It's much of the research is paid for by tax dollars, and every citizen has a right to see the work and be able to draw down from the internet and read the studies, the fascinating studies and the exciting work that's being done. And so I think the individual on the street who likes science, and I hope there are lots of them, have an opportunity then to read directly what's being published.
Now, how is that different than the traditional way in which peer-reviewed journals would be developed?
You'd have to subscribe as a member of a society to get the journal that's published by the society, which means paying dues. And then if you were not a member of the society and you wished to have a certain publication, you'd have to pay for the publication. And I think if you've paid for it in the first place as a taxpayer for the work to be done, you might earn
a little indicator.
you might deserve to be able to read it.
But it does have to be paid for somehow. What's that idea?
It has to be paid for, and that is through advertising, also through the dues paid by membership, and through the taxpayer dollars. So ultimately, it does get paid for, but it's disseminated widely, broadly to average citizen as well as fellow scientists.
You've been a university professor, still are, been a government administrator. It's a long way to being an entrepreneur. How has that been different for you?
Very different. Business operates very differently from science. I've had to learn a lot. It took a while before I understood the difference between a common stock and a preferred stock, but now I know.
So easier or harder than science?
I think it's probably a bit harder because you need to be more of a sociologist. And I think those talents are really, I admire people who have those talents. It's been very interesting because with business, it's a bottom line. But I feel a tremendous satisfaction in that what we're doing is translating science in a way that benefits people. It cures diseases. It provides rapid diagnosis. It helps people get better. It helps understand. We're working very hard on diseases like chronic fatigue syndrome, Lyme disease. These are tough ones to identify, to diagnose. And I think this molecular genetic approach that Cosmos ID takes is the way to go. And we're working hard on that. So being able to do good and at the same time provide a profit for that we can then use benevolently for charity, I think is great.
Now, you say benevolently for charity. The results aren't getting you a huge mansion on the eastern shore of Maryland. What's that?
In my hopes and dreams that I will be able to provide funded professorships and provide funding for research, I think this needs to be, for my own personal interest, I think this is how we pay back the wonderful opportunities I've had in this country, being able to, as a woman, to succeed in science, to lead the greatest, most wonderful basic research organization in the world, the National Science Foundation of the United States, and then to have the opportunity to be an entrepreneur, and at the same time to have a wonderful husband and two terrific children. It's been great.
I've been speaking with Dr. Rita Colwell, founder and chair of Cosmos ID. We'll talk more after a break. Podcasts of Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are available at iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast syndication outlets. Coming up in the second half of our show on Biotech Nation, transitioning biopharmaceutical drugs, which must be infused, into pills. We'll talk about one Darwinian approach. And Shock, one company's approach to intervening early. Stay with us. You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm speaking with Dr. Rita Colwell, former director of the National Science Foundation and the founder and chair of Cosmos ID. Well, I'll tell you, Rita, it's really interesting for me because people who come out of science, engineering, frequently they become entrepreneurs early on, you know, late 20s, early 30s, and you waited and probably spent most of your life not knowing you were going to become an entrepreneur. And so in a real sense, as a professor of management, we in our business, a biotech program, we take people from the lab bench to market-ready product. You know, it's like, yeah, science is great, but unless we can get it to somebody, it's not doing any good. And it's like, it's the last step. And I think that there's a lot of people out there who have done all kinds of things in science, engineering, technology, who's like, yeah, maybe later on you can become an entrepreneur. Is that a good strategy?
The ethos has changed. It has changed dramatically. When I started out as a scientist, it was not considered true to science to go into business. It was a bit of a distorted view, but it was a general view. And if you intended to become an academic, you would ensure that you would take a postdoc and then move into academia or move directly into academia. Very rarely would you go from industry to academia. But it has changed. It has changed quite dramatically. Of course, now my concern is that the universities must remain the place where you educate the next generation to think and to create, and not necessarily turn them into business people as freshmen, but give them a chance to mature and to gain wisdom and then to move into business. To be creative, certainly, but I think it's really important to have that time period of development, if you will. But I do see this changed, and now it's good that you can go from business to the university or the university to business or be at the university and be involved in business. That change, I think, is healthy and good for the country. But we must be very careful that we don't turn our universities into business factories. That's not, I think, what the university should be. So we have to be careful about that.
And some people are just terrific scientists or engineers or whatever they are. Being an entrepreneur, founding a company, it's really not cut out for everybody.
I think that it's difficult to make that transition. In fact, what I feel strongly is that it would be very useful to include as part of the general curriculum, along with civics and English and chemistry and math, a little bit of business training. I think it would be very useful, for example, for when I was in academic administration, vice president of the University of Maryland system, it would have been helpful to have had perhaps a course in how to read a spreadsheet, for example.
Good start.
or how to manage a little bit of human resources, how you manage difficult situations in a wise and sensible way. You learn that, but it would seem to me helpful to have sort of business 101 that you could take as an undergraduate, even though you're majoring in astrophysics or molecular biology. It would be helpful to be able to interpret the business arena in a much more rigorous and intelligent way from the beginning, rather than wait until you've made the mistakes.
Well, it is interesting you would say that. I don't know any CEO that has not had to learn over time about how to hire people and when, well, gee, this is just not working out, whether you're great but not in the group I need or whatever. What have you learned about picking people to come to work for you?
It requires a lot of consideration. It's important to be able to assess the talent of the individual and his or her drive and ability to to complete tasks and to be efficient and effective. It's not easy, and I haven't always succeeded, but I think I can say that I've had great success because my graduate students have all done well. Partly because, first of all, they're very good and very smart. But secondly, I think we interacted well. And the training, much of which was individual, being able to function in the laboratory, that is, selecting students who did not need a whole lot of guidance, but could carry out experiments with a minimum kind of interaction, and who were creative in being able to think about the experiments they wanted to do next, resulted in a cohort of really, really smart people turning out to be very successful. Chairs of departments, four of the students are now members of the National Academy of Science as well, and in companies, in business, and a couple have started their own business. So it's been a combination. And I think you learn that over the years. And for women, I think it's very important to understand that when something goes wrong, it isn't always the woman's fault, which is the tendency we have of blaming ourselves. The person who is carrying out the problem may be the problem. So recognizing that, again, is part of human resources, human development, and understanding it.
Well, Rita, such a pleasure. We could talk for a long time, but we've run out. Please come back. Don't be a stranger.
Thank you very much. Do invite me. This has been a pleasure.
My guest today is Dr. Rita Colwell. She's the founding editor of GeoHealth, a new journal from the American Geophysical Union. The journal GeoHealth is now accepting submissions, and publication fees will be waived for manuscripts submitted through January 31st, 2017. More information on the bioinformatics company Cosmos ID can be found at cosmosid.com. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. The world we know is changing. Welcome to Biotech Nation. Today on Biotech Nation, transitioning biopharmaceutical drugs, which must be infused in the bloodstream, into easy-to-take pills. We talk about one Darwinian approach. Then shock, a devastating condition which does far more damage than we realize, and one company's approach to intervening early. Biopharmaceutical drugs, the so-called biologics, are large molecules. As a result, patients must go to infusion centers to infuse them directly. I asked Dr. Kevin Jadis, president and CEO of Dice Molecules, why can't we just put them in a pill?
That's a good question. So there are a couple of different reasons. The first is that the large molecules are proteins, and your body's sort of set up that if you ingest proteins orally, your stomach digests them and turns them into nutrients for you.
All kinds of things.
Yeah, all kinds
Before it gets to your body.
Yeah, none of which are actually productive drugs in your system. So they get digested. But even if you could get them through the stomach, there's another problem that has to do with just the sheer physical size of them. They can't permeate their way across the various barriers in the intestinal tract and make their way into the bloodstream. Uh-huh. So if you think about it, your body is set up to be very careful about what it lets into the bloodstream, right? And you want to have a process going on in your gut where when you eat things, you digest them into things you want, and those things are transported across or diffused across, but not everything gets across.
Right.
A lot of it gets out as waste. So there's just not a good process for getting those things through the gut and into your bloodstream. Ergo, you have to be treated via an infusion center or something like that.
And then when they're small and you make pills out of them, that's what we call, was it medicinal chemistry?
Correct.
If they're small enough, yep, we can actually make it a pill.
Yeah, that's right. The nomenclature that's jargon in the industry is large molecules and small molecules. And it really just breaks down to small molecules are small enough entities and stable enough entities that they can go through your gut and pass into your bloodstream and then go do their work, whereas the large molecules just have to be given straight into the bloodstream.
Now let's jump over to business. people much prefer pills than having to go and stick a needle into their arm and infuse these biopharmaceutical drugs slowly into your bloodstream. Why can't we just go and somehow make those into pills, find ways to make them smaller and put them in pills?
Yeah, people have tried that for about 20 years now, maybe a little bit longer. And the idea that we had, and this is how I actually started my career, was we'll just look at the way the protein therapeutic binds to its target, and we'll just view it as kind of a lost wax thing, you know, and we'll take the parts of it that interdigitate with its target and we'll mimic those parts. And
we'll just take the little guys.
Yeah, we'll just throw away the rest of this stuff.
We don't need the rest of all this junk.
All this spinach that nature put on there, that's just nature just wasting time and energy, right?
Yeah.
You know, we know better than nature. So we tried that, and it turns out we don't know better than nature. There are a lot of things that we just didn't get right back in the 90s doing that. So mimicking the proteins turns out not to be a useful way to make smaller drugs out of larger ones.
But that didn't stop you. You want to make small pills, right?
We do. Yeah, we really do. And there are a couple of reasons. You mentioned one. It's much more convenient for patients and maybe a little bit safer to not have to get an infusion, you know, every month. The more interesting reason and the really exciting reason is that there are a lot of targets that live inside cells that simply can't be accessed by these biomolecules. And we know now, after 10, 15 years of really good genetics and genomics, a lot of those targets are super critical in processes like cell growth. So they're important targets for cancer.
And where we don't want that cell to grow.
Where we don't want that cell to grow, yeah. So they get stuck in some kind of on position, and we'd like to have a molecule that would turn it back off. So a lot of successful cancer therapeutics over the past 10 years have been biologics, these large molecules that are infused in the bloodstream, and they can do a wonderful job of shutting down processes that are out of control as long as those processes are happening outside the cell. But if they're happening inside the cell, there's no way for those biologics to get in. So you'd really like a small molecule that can penetrate the cell to get in and start shutting down some of those targets. And it's frustrating for people in the industry because we all know these are great targets. They just are behind this barrier we can't get to. So that's one of the main reasons we're working on the area of small molecules at DICE is to get them into cells and really hit some targets that we think are going to make a big difference in patient lives.
I can't figure out whether this is just the Wild West where you're just looking at everything and trying to figure out how can we do this, but you know, you don't have any specific molecules, or you have some specific ideas and specific conditions. Which is it?
It's a little of both. It's a Wild West in the sense that we try not to bias our thinking going in. So we I think learned a lot and were humbled as a group. We learned some humility back in the 90s, right? We learned that, you know, things that are obvious to us really can't translate naturally into the settings we want them to translate to. So we can't just do a simple mimicry of nature. We have to be more open-minded. So when we construct our collections of molecules, we try and be as agnostic as we can be about what they look like physically, how they point out into space. So I always think of the center of a molecule as maybe living inside a sphere, and we want to display information around the edge of that sphere. We want to cover all the hemispheres, right? We don't want to leave any parts of that globe blank. And we just want to see what's going to fit into our target of interest without biasing ourselves by our own preconceived notions. All right. Now, having said that, we choose to make collections of molecules that live within certain size ranges. So we know going in there are certain size ranges that are likely to penetrate cells. And remember, that's one of the main reasons we're doing all this. So we want to stay in a certain size range, you know, how much the molecule weighs. We don't want it to get too heavy. And so we'll bias those initial collections of compounds, which we call libraries, right? For the same reason that collections of books are libraries. There's a lot of information in there and you don't know which one you want. So we make these libraries of compounds, large collections of compounds. We bias them a little bit, but we try and go in there with as many solutions as we can. So maybe one way to think about it is, you know, one of the oldest concepts in the pharma industry is the lock and key theory, right? That there's going to be for every protein, you can think of it as a lock, and there's a site on the protein where a molecule could bind, and one and only one key or molecule is going to fit into that site. We want to go in with a wide collection of possible keys that can fit into a wide variety of locks.
Now, how is what you're doing different from what Big Pharma does in developing small molecule drugs?
It has some similarities, but it's radically different in the core of what we're doing. So the similarities are we use the knowledge that Big Pharma and nowadays even small pharma has always used to develop small molecule drugs. We know what sizes roughly they need to be. We know certain features of the molecule you'd like to have and otherwise would like to avoid. So there are things that can cause trouble. You want to stay away from those. So we use the collected knowledge of the industry. But where DICE differs is that we're combining the power of biology to do things like evolution on an expedited scale. Some people call that directed evolution. So we're using directed evolution but bringing that to chemistry for the first time. And that's what's really exciting. If you think about it, biologists have known for 20, 30 years how to evolve protein therapeutics, large molecules, to do just about anything they want. And that's relatively new. I mean, in the scheme of things, 20, 30 years is a long time. But in the history of our industry, it's pretty new. So now you have all this power if you're a biologist. If you want a large molecule, you can make anything you pretty much think of. It'll do this. It'll do that. And all you're doing is applying selective pressure, the way that Darwin first described, for finches back in the Galapagos. What we're doing is that same process, but in a way that's going to yield small molecules. So we can evolve small molecules in the same way that until very recently you could only do it with proteins or large molecules. And that's what's really cool. That's what we're really excited about.
Kevin, some of this I don't totally understand, but I totally get that you're onto something here. Is that good enough?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's a good synopsis.
Is that a good synopsis?
Yeah,
you. It's like you're not just getting, huge libraries of compounds and throwing them at situations and see what binds. You're saying we're intelligently using how things develop, that mm-hmm. we're seeing how they develop. We know how they develop in the biologic area.
Yeah.
And now we're doing that in the chemistry area. In fact, you used to work for Genentech.
Correct.
So they were just as interested in this as anybody else.
Yeah. I mean, Genentech certainly has pioneered a lot of methodologies in the directed evolution of biologics. They've been really on the leading edge of that. And one of the things that they have really, I think, been the leader in the industry on for decades now is the production of monoclonal antibodies. So antibodies that can target any particular thing you want in the body, and those have turned out to be incredibly useful in cancer, in oncology. So we, in the 90s, watched that happen at Genentech. It was a very impressive thing to watch, and it certainly left a big impression on me as a young scientist. And so in the back of my mind, I've always thought, well, gee, if you could do that with chemistry, that would be fantastic. But nobody ever had a way to do it with chemistry. So our founder is a guy by the name of Per Harbury, who's at Stanford, very bright guy, worked on this for 15 years and came up with a way to do it with chemistry. And so now you can do all the same tricks. So you can cross up the genes, you can essentially hybridize small molecules the same way you can hybridize plants or something. You want more optimal corn, you can hybridize.
Mix them up.
Mix them up, rub the tassels together. So we can conceptually do the same thing with our molecules and allow the best ones to emerge from a very large collection, again, without preconceived notions, right? All you're asking for, I mean, in the corn analogy, all you want is big corn. You don't really care how that all happened. You're rubbing tassels together, and when the big ones come up, you plant more of those.
Yeah.
Right?
That's
been done since people first walked out of caves, right? And we're just trying to bring that same level of thinking and agnosticism, which I think is really important. We don't – I learned my lesson in the 90s, right? We thought we had it all figured out.
We were so smart.
Yeah, we'll just make this little widget and fit it in there and whir. It's the sad trumpet thing. Wah, wah, wah. That doesn't work, right? So now we've taken a lesson from nature and we're just saying, okay, we're going to run this process and we're going to wait for the right solutions to emerge. And after the fact, we can write all kinds of papers explaining how this all makes sense.
Right.
But it's the solutions we're interested in.
And I think there's also a great lesson here. It's like we know that today that no matter which of the sciences and engineering and all of this, all the big breakthroughs are coming when we cross these what are standard silos of science and engineering. And there's more to crossing those silos than we realize. And this is where all the new stuff emerges. And it sounds like that's where you guys are.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. And there are a number of people involved with the company. So our founder, Per Harbury, our chief scientific officer is a guy by the name of Phil Patton. Those two gentlemen have trafficked at the intersection of chemistry and biology their whole careers. And I agree with you. That's where the really fertile stuff comes from, because things that are obvious to a chemist might be completely opaque to a biologist and vice versa. But if you get all those folks in a room together, some really magical things can happen. And that's, I think, what happened when Per invented this technology.
Well, come on back. See us again. We want to hear about the magic.
That's great. Thanks so much for having us.
Dr. Kevin Judice is the president and CEO of Dice Molecules. More information is available at dicemolecules.com. That's Dice, D-I-C-E, dicemolecules.com. We've all heard of shock, and that in any number of situations, people go into shock. I asked Dr. Thomas Hallam, the head of clinical development and regulatory affairs at Leading Biosciences, what is shock?
Shock is when the body experiences dangerously low blood pressure. Essentially, when the blood pressure drops too low, the body's tissues don't get enough blood supply. And this can happen through a number of different insults, right? If it's an infection, patient could get septic shock, or if it's a trauma, patient could bleed and have hemorrhagic shock. And when this low blood pressure occurs, basically certain parts of the body don't get adequate blood tissue. And we've discovered one of the critical components of shock is the blood flow to an area of the body called the mucosal barrier.
I didn't even know I had one, Tom.
Yeah.
Where is this?
We all have one. We have one that is this very thin layer in our small intestine. It separates the contents in our small intestine, the digestive enzymes, the bacteria, the food we ate for our last meal, and separates that from our intestine and our internal organs. And basically, we've discovered that barrier is very sensitive to the oxygenation and the blood pressure. And for long periods of time, for a patient goes through a period of shock, there's not enough blood supply to that barrier, and it breaks down. And the enzymes then within the small intestine can leak out, and they can leak into the abdomen and actually begin to digest the patient's own organs from the inside out.
Well, I'm in shock about your description of shock.
Yeah.
That's just the way it goes. But what occurs to me is that shock is not just accidents. Like anytime you have an operation, I mean, there's any number of shocks to the body. Is it the same shock whenever we go through this?
So it's a great question. You can get into shock from any number of different possible entryways or insults, right? But what we found is at the end of the day, it's this low blood pressure is the triggering event that is really the driver of the breakdown of the mucosal barrier and the driver of the multi-organ failure that results from it.
So anytime you get this really low blood pressure mm-hmm. situation for a sustained period of time, that's what we're looking at.
That's exactly right. Shock in particular is way more prevalent than most people thought. In fact, there's about 1.3 million cases of shock in the United States each year, with over 25% of those resulting in death. In fact, recently, there's been a number of celebrity deaths that have been reported to be from shock. In particular, Muhammad Ali's family released that his cause of death was actually septic shock from an infection and not from the Parkinson's that most people would associate with him. One of the things that I think is really important to know is that there's not a lot of treatments out there for shock. There's not a lot of things that you can do once someone goes into shock, except for kind of standard of care and kind of organ replacement therapy.
So you were saying there's not a lot we could do about shock.
Right. You know, if you look at historically over the last two decades, there have been a number of different treatments that have been tried to be developed for treating shock. And basically the last 65 clinical trials trying to develop new drugs or treatments for this have failed. And where we're at with Leading Biosciences is we have a new treatment we think that can stop the breakdown of the mucosal barrier and actually prevent these digestive enzymes from damaging the patient's organs and actually allow them to survive through this period of shock and come out the other side and live.
So you're looking at a delay then, a delay just so it can finally just recover and you're out of the shock condition,
right.
If you will. Now, when do you administer this?
So if a patient goes into shock, basically, if they're conscious, they'd be they drink this. Otherwise, it'd be administered through a tube into their stomach. But most importantly, the critical factor is the drug has to be administered to their directly into their stomach or small intestine. That's where the drug needs to be because that's where those enzymes are that break down that barrier. And when we can get our drug directly there, we can show that we can stop those digestive enzymes and then stop the subsequent breakdown of tissue from the digestive enzymes.
So it's here, drink this.
Exactly.
Now here, that drink you have this devastating event that happened to you.
Yeah,
this could be problematic. So delivery is a challenge for you.
It could be a challenge, but you know, we think about it like this. A lot of times that the drug can be used basically from the ICU to the field to the battlefield, right? Where if you have an event where someone could trigger an event of shock, patient can drink this on a prophylactic basis, right? Where patient, imagine you're a soldier on a battlefield, right? You get a wound that's bleeding, right? And the soldier then can mix this with their canteen water and drink it, right? And basically preserve that mucosal barrier and allow them to survive that period of time to where they get adequate medical care.
I'm a little amazed at the numbers you have of people dying from shock. I don't recall shock as being, you know, the diagnosis or the cause of death.
This is a really great insight. If you look at someone, for example, that was in a severe car accident and had a bleeding episode, right? The death certificate will say, you know, motor vehicle accident. It doesn't say that, oh, the patient was actually, you know, fine. They went to the hospital and the emergency room where for a while they missed the fact there was this internal bleeding and eventually they went through this period of shock. So it's usually there's usually a death certificate that says a cause of death is something above that level where you get to that final episode of shock that really can be the crisis for that patient.
So you've got to get in there and understand that in a certain set of circumstances, get ahead of the game here.
Get ahead of the game.
Now, where are you from compound to accept registered product? Where are you in that arc?
Great question. We are now at that point where we're actually in phase two clinical trials. So we're actually testing this in patients now in the United States, and we're going to get the data to prove whether or not this hypothesis is right. We actually can stop this process in the small intestine and preserve these patients' lives.
Do you hang out at emergency rooms? How are you doing this? How do you recruit people into this?
You know, believe it or not, that's almost what we do. We have the hospitals that enroll these clinical trials. They have monitors that are and alert systems to find these patients when they come into the hospitals so that they can treat them right away with their own procedures. And then we piggyback onto their own procedures.
They're not coming out of it. Maybe we can do this. Maybe this is an option.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, good luck to you. Tom, please come back and see us. We'd like to get updated on this story.
Great. Thank you so much, Myra.
Dr. Thomas Hallam is the head of clinical development and regulatory affairs at Leading Biosciences. More information is available at leadingbiosciences.com. For Biotech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
Tech Nation and its regular segment Biotech Nation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Mahler, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are productions of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Landcore.